The third case for oral argument this morning is Poirier. Am I pronouncing that correctly?
Poirier.
Okay, thank you. Versus the South Dakota Department of Revenue. Ms. Vanya Hogan for the appellants, Poirier, and Mr. Larry Long, Assistant Attorney General for the State of South Dakota Department of Revenue. Justice Zinner has disqualified himself as he was the trial judge in this case, and the court has appointed the Honorable Art Rush, the presiding judge of the First Judicial Circuit from Vermilion, to sit in his place. Ms. Hogan, you may proceed.
May it please the court, counsel. Good morning. My name is Vanya Hogan, and I represent the appellants, Lauren Poirier, doing business as Muddy Creek Oil and Gas, Inc., and Muddy Creek Oil and Gas, Inc. Lauren Poirier, whose nickname is Bat Poirier, is an enrolled member of the Oglala Sioux Tribe. He has owned and operated a convenience store and gas station on the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation in the village of Pine Ridge for the past 12 and a half years. At all times relevant to this litigation, he gets the fuel that he sells at his Pine Ridge store from a terminal rack in Nebraska and imports it directly onto the Pine Ridge Reservation to the village of Pine Ridge, where he sells it. Since 1995, in November of 1995 to be exact, Bat Poirier has been licensed by the state of South Dakota through the corporation that he wholly owns, Muddy Creek Oil and Gas, Inc., to import, market, and distribute motor fuel within the state of South Dakota. He originally applied for those licenses in July of 1995 and was denied the licenses by the department because the department feared that he wouldn't charge South Dakota's motor fuel tax. After an administrative hearing, that decision was reversed and the department was ordered to grant licenses both to Mr. Poirier and to Muddy Creek Oil and Gas, Inc. to import, market, and distribute fuel in South Dakota. For whatever reason, a license was only issued in the name of Muddy Creek Oil and Gas, Inc. There wasn't a second license or second set of licenses issued in the name of Bat Poirier.
What took him so long to challenge the tax?
He actually began challenging the tax as soon as he started applying for the license, is kind of when the fight was engaged between Mr. Poirier and the department over the payment of these taxes, because they assumed immediately that the reason that he was trying to import his own fuel was that he didn't want to have to pay taxes on that. Basically,
so the tax then has built up to close to $100,000 in the interim?
In the interim, since he started challenging this tax in late 1995, it has built up to about $930,000. That's at least what was at issue at the time this went to Judge Zinter. He's been filing challenges ever since, and I don't actually know the total now, but the amount that is at issue in this litigation is about $930,000. The question before the court today is whether the state of South Dakota, through its Department of Revenue, can tax the sale of motor fuel imported directly from Nebraska to the Pine Ridge Reservation and sold by an Indian on the reservation. The United States Supreme Court has said that, absent congressional authorization, states cannot tax Indians in Indian country. It's a bright-line rule. They've also said that for Congress to authorize a state to tax Indians in Indian country, Congress must make its intent to allow that taxation unmistakably clear. In answering the question before the court today about whether this tax is permissible, the court has to look at two issues. First, did Congress expressly authorize the state of South Dakota to impose its motor fuel tax on Indians in Indian country within South Dakota? And secondly, if Congress did not authorize the tax, does the legal incidence of South Dakota's motor fuel tax actually fall on an Indian in Indian country and is therefore prohibited, which would mean that Mr. Poirier would be entitled to a refund?
What does the term incidence mean?
There's legal incidence, which is what we look at in these Indian law tax cases, really means legal liability. Who is responsible for the taxes, not necessarily the person who actually is remitting it to the state, but the person who bears the legal liability. With respect to this first issue, as to whether Congress has authorized the state of South Dakota to impose the tax.
Do we have to get to the incident? If wasn't it argued that the tax wasn't even included in the price?
One of the arguments, a factual determination that was made in front of the hearing examiner and that Judge Zinter affirmed, was that there was a factual dispute over whether that courier actually passed the tax on to his consumers. Whether he passed the tax on, however, is not it's one of the factors that the court looks at in terms of legal incidents, but that's really the economic incidents. Who in the end of the day, at the end of the day, is paying the tax? That's the economic incidence of the tax. And this court doesn't have to get into that analysis. In fact, the U.S. Supreme Court has said it's too complicated for courts to engage in that analysis. That's why we use this legal incidence
test. Well, but if your client is selling at what he characterizes as a commercial rate, the Native American is pulling up to the gas station is pretty well paying it, isn't he?
That was disputed. Bat Poirier took the position throughout the hearing, and there was uncontroversial testimony that he did not pass the tax on to his consumers. Whether he passed the tax on to his consumers or not, though, does not end the inquiry.
He was charging the same rate as the other stations that were charging it, isn't it?
Well, there wasn't any evidence as to whether those other stations were, expressly adding the tax in or not. What he testified to was that the way he set his rate was by looking at the stations down the street and pricing his gas within a penny of that. So there wasn't a calculation, did they put the tax in? Should we put the tax in? They just simply looked at what the price of their competitors were and tried to stay within a penny.
If a competitor was selling, say, $1.45 a gallon and paying the tax, he was somewhere between $1.44 and $1.46, then, right?
That was the testimony, yes.
And there's no showing in the record whatsoever that he looked at the market price and he looked at his competitors and then sold for 20 or 20 cents less the amount of the tax below that figure, is there? There's nothing in the record to establish that.
There's nothing in the record to that effect. And that really doesn't matter because...
I guess we'll decide if it matters or not, but it is clear then that there is no proof in the record that he did not collect the tax.
Not sure if I followed
that. There's no affidavit to the effect that he sold the gas at a market rate, but he always sold it for 22 cents or 20 cents less.
That's correct. There was testimony both from Mr. Poirier and from his wife, who was the secretary of his corporation, that they never specifically took into consideration the tax. They just looked at what the market would bear. In these cases, though, in cases involving who bears the legal incidence of the tax and therefore who is entitled to the refund, courts have found in certain cases, this retailer probably passed the tax on to the consumer, but because the retailer is the one who bore the legal incidence of the tax, it is the retailer rather than the consumer who gets the refund. We can't really tell. I mean, it would take a sophisticated economic analysis, that U.S. Supreme Court has said in a case called Oklahoma Tax Commission versus Chickasaw Nation. It would take a very sophisticated analysis to really see in the end, economically, whether the tax was passed on. And that's why the court says, we don't look at that. We're going to look at these other several factors that determine who bears the legal incidence of the tax.
But is it really that difficult in this case? The department's sitting on apparently about $1 million, and if they can't keep it, then either your client gets it or his ultimate customers get it. And your client has admitted he's selling at the commercial rate where the tax is imposed. What's so difficult about that?
Well, it's just not the test that the U.S. Supreme Court says has to be applied in these cases when you're determining who bears the legal incidence of a tax and whether an Indian bears the legal incidence of the tax. There are other factors that have to be looked at. For one thing, you look at if the state is arguing that the consumer actually pays the tax, can the consumer ever get in trouble for not paying the tax? Well, the answer is no. You can look through the entire South Dakota motor fuel statutes, and you will not find any section that says, if you get pulled over and you can't show that you paid tax on the gas in your tank that you're going to get in trouble. But if you are a marketer and you have not paid taxes, you can get in big trouble. In fact,
that's... Did he actually pay the tax? I'm sorry for the interruption, but did he actually pay the tax where right at the rack that you referred to, or did he pay the tax upon bringing it into the state and then filling out forms and paying it, or did he fill out forms after he had in effect sold it, in other words, had the money from his consumers and then used that money to pay the tax?
It's a little confusing in the importation when you're importing it from out of state, especially where the person who's importing the fuel is also the person who is marketing the fuel, because the statutes don't, they just simply don't make it absolutely clear when the tax burden transfers from the importer to the marketer. But it is clear that Muddy Creek Oil and Gas had to pay the taxes before it was sold to any consumers. So it wasn't as though they were collecting the money from the consumers and then paying the tax. The importer...
What makes that clear in the record? Is there an affidavit or is there proof, evidence of it?
There's a lot of testimony about how the money is actually swept out of the accounts and how that happens prior to it actually getting to the Pine Ridge store to be sold. The Muddy Creek, as an importer, gets the fuel from a terminal rack in Nebraska. They, as the importer, are the ones who have to remit the tax. Basically, they're the ones who are collecting the tax from the state, and who they're collecting it from, and this is what makes it seem a little confusing in this instance, is the marketer, who happens to also be Muddy Creek in this case. It's a little easier...
So he pays the tax in Nebraska, you're saying?
No, he doesn't pay the tax in Nebraska. I think it may be swept out of his account in Nebraska, but it goes, you know, it gets paid to South Dakota.
By the Nebraska rack.
By Muddy Creek Oil and Gas.
Okay. Who completes the forms that pays the tax?
Muddy Creek Oil and Gas completes those forms.
And they'll do that then right when they're picking up the petroleum at the rack?
Yes. I believe that that's correct. If it's not right when they pick it up, then it's immediately after that they have to remit the taxes.
Well, how could it be immediately after? I mean, he'd be taking the petroleum tank and hauling it back to the, you know, crossing the border and then coming into the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation?
The reason I'm hesitating a little bit and getting a little off here is that I think that the forms get filled out possibly at a different time than when the money is actually swept out of the account, which may happen when they actually pick it up in Nebraska, and then they complete the forms later on.
Well, how it's paid, who by, when, the issue here is you say no tax is owing.
That's correct.
And you're saying it's not owing because it's a tax on the sovereign Indian reservation that shouldn't be, the state can't do, isn't that what you're arguing?
That is what I'm arguing, that because Congress has never authorized the state of South Dakota to impose its motor fuel tax within Indian reservations on Indians in South Dakota, the department simply doesn't have any authority to do that.
You got this nice billboard here. You got 7 minutes left. Let's talk about the Hayden Cartwright Act, okay?
The department argues that this 1936 statute, the Hayden Cartwright Act, authorizes the state of South Dakota to impose motor fuel taxes on Indian reservations in South Dakota. To get there, though, what they would have this court do is insert the word Indian in two different spots in this statute where it currently doesn't exist. First, in the phrase that's bolded there, the United States military or other reservations. This statute clearly authorizes states to levy motor fuel taxes for fuel sold on, and then it says United States military or other reservations. The state would have you read that as Indian, United States military, or other reservations. That's the only way that they can get where they need to go with this statute. But on its face, it does not apply to Indian reservations.
So you say in order to show a clear intent that it's taxable, the legislation should say Indian reservation.
Yes, and in fact, when Congress wants to include Indian reservations, when it's talking about contrasting with other reservations, it knows how to do that. These are just three examples, and we cited some others in our brief, where there's similar language about military reservations or other reservations, where Congress did the thing that makes it very clear and inserted the word Indian in there, or the second example, tribal lands embraced within Indian reservations.
Well, in the last one here, it says Indian,
military,
or other.
That's how the state would have you read the Hayden-Cartwright Act. But that's not what the Hayden-Cartwright Act says. If you look at the legislative history of the Hayden-Cartwright Act, it doesn't talk about Indians. It doesn't talk about Indian reservations. It doesn't talk about Indian tribes. That is because Indian reservations are fundamentally different from these other kinds of reservations. Military reservations or national parks or national monuments, where the federal government has come in and basically taken land away from a state.
Ms. Hogan, you refer to the monuments and parks, but are they commonly characterized as reservations?
They are in federal land law, and I think we've got cases to that effect, that that's what Congress was actually talking about when they used the term other reservations. It seems somewhat illogical just from a layperson perspective, because you don't think of a national park as a reservation, but that is the way that it has been interpreted, and it's clear from the legislative history that's what Congress was talking about. Unlike military reservations or national parks, Indian reservations were not carved out of a state by the federal government. They were reserved territories by Indian tribes out of a state. And Congress has said, because of that, because of the special relationship between the tribes who were there first and reserved their own lands, that's why we have separate rules. That's why it has to be unmistakably clear for Congress to authorize taxation of Indians when it doesn't. You know, the regular rules of statutory construction might apply when you're dealing with other groups of people. The other place in the Hayden-Cartwright Act that the department would have to insert the word Indian where it is not is in this phrase, licensed traders. The department says, and the circuit court, we think, found in error, that licensed traders is an Indian law term of art, that licensed traders is simply shorthand for the term licensed Indian traders. There's a statute that was passed in the 1800s under which Congress set up a scheme by which people who traded, mainly non-Indians who traded with Indians, had to get a license to do trading on Indian reservations with Indians. And the kind of license that they're required to get under that statute is an Indian license. They have to become, and this is the term in that statute, a licensed Indian trader. The department argues licensed Indian trader is just always shortened to licensed trader, so clearly when Congress used the term licensed trader here, they must have meant licensed Indian trader. This is the only statute, however, where Congress has ever used the phrase licensed trader. The department cites a lot of cases where the U.S. Supreme Court and other courts have referred to licensed Indian traders as licensed traders. I would urge this court to look very closely at those cases, however, because often when that term is used, Congress first uses the term licensed Indian trader, and then it will use a shorthand of licensed trader.
Well, didn't they have licensed traders at military posts, too?
That's exactly right. Not only did you have to be licensed to trade on an Indian reservation at the time the statute was passed, but you also had to have a license if you wanted to sell gas on a military reservation.
Now, there was an Idaho case. Isn't that the Goodman case? That goes along with what your position is in this case. And they said that there could be no taxation on Indian reservations by the state of Idaho, right?
That's correct.
Now, I see that after that, there's this a federal district court. And I think it's in FedSup. I got it.
Montana.
Yeah. And in that case, on page 4, I look up, it said, members of Congress appear to recognize that more explicit language is required, and that's what you're saying is required. Congress has had before two bills to allow taxation of fuel sales on Indian reservations. And then it talks about in the 98 and 99. Now, tell me, how did those bills come in front of? Was this in response to that decision in Idaho? Do you know? Have you looked that up?
I don't believe it was it may have been in response to the threat of litigation in Idaho, but the decision from the Idaho Supreme Court did not come down until, I think, 2001.
Yeah.
So I don't believe it was in response to the decision in the Idaho
case. But they didn't pass and change that.
No, they did not pass and change that. And while, I mean, that's sort of extra evidence that, look, Congress doesn't intend to tax Indian reservations, we don't think you even need to get that far because look at the statute. It's not unmistakably clear. The fact that you've got 100 pages of briefs in front of you, or excuse me, 200 pages of briefs between the parties in front of you about whether this is unmistakably clear, I think is proof in itself that the language is not unmistakably clear.
Were there, was the state of South Dakota, along with other states, amicus curiae in the Idaho Goodman case?
I don't know the answer to that. I don't believe that they did file an amicus brief, but they could have. I guess Mr. Long will have to answer that question. I know that that South Dakota has, in other cases before the U.S. Supreme Court, tried to argue that the Hayden-Cartwright Act authorized the tax.
But the first case in Idaho was in the state court.
That's correct.
And then the one I referred to was a subsequent case that was in a federal district court.
Right, because Idaho tries, even after the Goodman Oil case from its Supreme Court, it tried to tweak their statute a little bit to get out of paying the refunds, and the federal court said no. The tax is not authorized, and you can't do that.
Thank you, Counsel. Your time is up. I'll be back 10 minutes later. Mr. Long, you have 20 minutes, sir.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning, and may it please the Court. I would like to address one of the questions that the Chief Justice asked. I believe you asked, were there licensed traders on military reservations? And I would suggest to you that there is no authority for the proposition that there were ever licensed traders on military reservations, at least as that term is used in this statute or in any case law prior to 1936. And we believe that we have incorporated in our brief all of the appropriate case law which refers to licensed traders or licensed Indian traders, either one, and none of those prior to 1936 ever makes reference to licensed traders in the context of a military reservation. Even the statute you have here talks about it talks about military reservations, and if you recall from the briefs, what in fact happened was that certain phrases were added by the conference committee between the House and the Senate as this bill was passed in 1936. And what in fact happened was the original phrase, U.S. military and other reservations, was qualified by the words post exchanges, ship stores, ship service stores, commissaries. The conference committee added the phrase filling stations and licensed traders. Now, the addition of filling stations and licensed traders must mean something. There must have been some problem that the conference committee was trying to address when they added those two phrases. And it is our position that the addition of the phrase licensed traders means something. And what it means is, as the trial court found below, that the word licensed traders is an Indian law term of art and is only found either in statutory law or in the Code of Federal Regulations or in the Annals of Continental Congress or in federal case law context of Indian affairs.
Mr. Long, you say it must mean something, but your opponent has cited to the floor debates, especially the comments by Senator Hayden, who was from Arizona, that has a lot of reservations in that state. He had been in Congress since Arizona became a state in 1912, and I believe they say that those debates show he never once used the word Indian.
Well, if you refer to our brief, Your Honor, what you will find is that we traced Congressman Hayden's and ultimately Senator Hayden's attitude and his legislative history with reference to this particular issue way back to 1921. And he was constantly attempting to expand the application of the motor fuels tax into Indian lands, and he attempted on several occasions to do that. There's no question in my mind but what the legislative history indicates that that's exactly what Senator Hayden was attempting to do, and in fact did accomplish by this amendment to the Hayden-Cartwright Act. Now, I would follow that up by suggesting that in addition to that, of course, the Interior Board the Interior Solicitor in 1940 and the Menominee Mills opinion, which we've also cited in our brief, reached the same conclusion. And also the Attorney General of the United States in 1936 reached a very similar conclusion with reference to national parks. And one of the things that they both did in their analysis was they looked at the entire act, of which Hayden-Cartwright is only Section 10. And they worked through particularly Section 3 and found that non-taxable Indian lands and Indian reservation roads were made reference to. And so they both concluded that to examine the entire act, one has to conclude when Hayden-Cartwright says United States military or other reservations, they were talking about all of the reservations that had been previously talked about in the act. I think that is a legitimate and fair reading. But in any event, one must reach some type of a conclusion about what the United States, what Congress meant when they used the phrase licensed traders. And I reiterate my point. It is not found in any context prior to 1936 other than in Indian affairs, and it's referring to those individuals who were licensed by the federal government to trade with Indians.
Let's assume for a minute that we agree with you that the language licensed traders must mean something, to use your words. That's still a long ways from being, I mean, even though it must have meant something, that's still an awful long ways from being unmistakably clear, isn't it?
I disagree. Let me give you for an example. In the other major cases where the Congress has authorized the taxation of Indians in Indian country, and that would be the Yakima case and the Cass County case, the U.S. Supreme Court said the word alienability equals taxation. Now, they didn't use the word taxation. They didn't use the word free of taxation. They didn't use a phrase free of taxation. But what Congress said was the land is alienable, freely alienable. And the U.S. Supreme Court concluded that based upon that analysis, Congress had said in unmistakable terms, alienability means taxation. Now, it was unmistakably clear in that case. Now, licensed traders on U.S. And I would suggest to you this. Read the entire section. Read the entire phrase. And put the context on licensed traders where it must be. A licensed trader must show up on some reservation. Okay? He doesn't show up on a military reservation because military reservations are covered. They are covered through ship stores, ship service stores, commissaries, filling stations, fillings. Post exchanges, ship stores, ship service stores, commissaries. Okay. That's the universe of military reservations. So, filling stations and licensed traders are on some other reservation. And as both the Interior Solicitor and the Attorney General at the time found, licensed traders was particularly suggestive of Indian reservations. And in fact, they so held.
Now, this act is passed in 1936. The only two cases that are reported on this issue are come out of Idaho in, 2000-2001. What's been going on since 1936? Has the tax been paid or not paid, or isn't there anything in the record either way on that?
Well, the tax has been paid in South Dakota. The South Dakota Supreme Court, of course, dealt with it in the AGE case, which I believe was in the early 1970s.
But that was a non-Indian.
That was a non-Indian. However, the argument that was propounded by the petitioner in that case was that he was, in effect, an Indian. And the court, of course, in that case found that the Hayden-Cartwright Act applied and was... this court found in the AGE case that this phrase, United States military and other reservations, applied to the Pine Ridge Reservation, which is exactly the same reservation that we are here litigating today. I submit that if the court takes a different track from AGE, they're going to have to overrule the prior precedent of this court in that context.
I thought that AGE, that it wasn't necessarily argued on the Hayden-Cartwright Act, though. I thought it was sort of like someone said it's a dicta. Was that an issue in the case?
The issue, the taxpayer was a non-Indian corporation. No doubt about that.
That had a contract to do road work out there.
He had a contract to do road work on the Pine Ridge Reservation. What the court found, the statement that the court made, was that the Hayden-Cartwright Act constituted specific congressional authorization for the state of South Dakota to impose its motor fuel taxes on the Pine Ridge and Rosebud Indian Reservations, which is where this contractor worked. I think the court ultimately concluded that he was not an Indian, and for that reason ultimately concluded that he was not exempt from the tax. He argued, however, that he was an Indian. And the court disposed in part of that argument, at least in part, with that argument by applying Hayden-Cartwright to the Pine Ridge and Rosebud Indian Reservations. Now, with reference to the this, I would point out to the court that the Goodman case, upon which Puyer and Muddy Creek rely, is grounded in large part upon a misreading of the Falls City Brewing Company case in 1941. The Falls City Brewing Company case had to do with a post exchange, and the post exchange, after the passage of the Buck Act in 1940, didn't want to pay the alcohol beverage licenses of the state of Kentucky. And they brought an action to determine whether or not the post exchange was a federal instrumentality. In that connection, there is a statement in the Falls City case which makes reference to government reservations. In fact, what the court was referring to in that case was a statement out of the Buck Act legislative history, which we have quoted verbatim in our brief, and the entire quote, I think, is significant, because Congressman Buck, in introducing the bill, said, "There is a minor problem involved and presented which involves the responsibility for such taxes as might be paid on sales at commissaries, licensed traders, and other similar agencies. We had some bad situations with regard to these licensed traders. There are licensed traders on certain reservations, for example, at Palm Springs, California. You have your reservation line right down the street, and on one side of the street you have merchants who are paying sales taxes, and on the other side you have licensed traders who are not paying any sales taxes on identically the same types of goods." Now, the significance of that is twofold. First of all, the judge in Falls City Brewing takes this quote and misreads it as Congressman Buck talking about some type of a government reservation, and Congressman Buck is clearly talking about an Indian reservation in that case. Now,
well, Ms. Hogan indicates in her brief that you might have been referring to the Joshua Tree Monument.
Well, we have referred, I think we've cited the Aggia-Kalenti case for the proposition that the Aggia-Kalenti tribe owns 26,000 acres of land within the city limits of Palm Springs. The Joshua Tree Monument, all I can tell you, Your Honors, I went and got an atlas and found out that it's about 15 miles east of Palm Springs, best I can tell. But we believe the case law suggests that the Palm Springs Reservation is the Aggia-Kalenti and literally would fit these facts based upon that case. Now, the significance of this, Your Honor, is this. This is legislative history with reference to the Buck Act. The Buck Act was passed in 1940, and several things happened in the Buck Act. The first thing that happened was that sales taxes and income taxes were expanded to include the power of states to impose sales taxes and income taxes were expanded into, quote, federal areas. And the concern in that case, or concern among the Buck Act proponents, was that American Indians would be caught up in the net of being imposed, being exposed to state sales taxes and state income taxes by virtue of the application of the Buck Act. So with reference to sales taxes and income taxes, there's a section of the Buck Act that says that Indians are excepted from those provisions. But the last part of the Buck Act amended the Hayden-Cartwright Act and added new language which was designed to expand the scope of application of motor fuels taxes. And it added this language up here. With respect to or measured by sales, purchases, storage, or use of gasoline or other motor fuels. Now, the reason that was added was because several states were attempting to, or several taxpayers were attempting to avoid application of the Hayden-Cartwright Act to themselves by saying that the narrower previous language did not require them to pay the motor fuels tax. And so they were expanding the tax. At the same time, they did not exempt American Indians from the application of this section. And they well could have. They exempted the Indians in the same act from the sales tax they were imposing and from the income tax they were imposing. They had the opportunity and they did not. We believe that's additional congressional intent to expose American Indians and impose and authorize the state of South Dakota to impose the motor fuel tax. Now, I briefly discussed the Goodman Oil case. I believe it's based on a misreading of Congressman Buck's statement, which I just read. In addition to that, I would like to talk about the subsequent federal case, which is followed after the Goodman case. I believe it's called Hammond. Now, Hammond is an interesting case as well. After the Goodman case, the state of Idaho went back and read Chickasaw. And they read the provision in Chickasaw which says that the state is free to place the legal incidence of their motor fuels tax wherever they want to. And consequently, they placed the legal incidence of their motor fuels tax on the consumer. The plaintiffs in the Hammond case then brought an action in U.S. District Court to enjoin the collection of that tax. And what happened in Hammond was the federal court determined that even though the state of Idaho had placed the legal incidence on the consumer, that they were not simply free to do that. We believe that teaching is contrary to the plain language in Chickasaw. And for that reason, Hammond is contrary to the stated position of the U.S. Supreme Court and that the state of Idaho should have been allowed to place the legal incidence wherever they felt it was appropriate. And Chickasaw, in our view, says that plainly. They make no mention, Hammond makes no mention of the licensed trader analysis. They simply adopt the Goodman Oil analysis with reference to that. And as I've said before, the Goodman Oil analysis is based on a faulty reading of Falls City Brewing. And for that reason, I suggest that this court follow its own prior precedents and not that of the state of Idaho. And
The state of South Dakota has legislatively, they have placed the incidence of the tax upon the consumer also. So you think that's absolutely binding and controlling under Chickasaw?
We believe that that's exactly correct. We believe that's what Chickasaw teaches, and all of the analysis that the plaintiff has, Puyer and Muddy Creek have engaged in their brief and their reply brief, we believe is a misreading of Chickasaw, because Chickasaw clearly says the state is generally free to place the legal incidents wherever they like, and that that the analysis that was engaged in by Puyer and Muddy Creek is only applicable, is only appropriate, and is only necessary if there is no dispositive language placing the legal incidents where, if there's dispositive language, then that resolves the inquiry. The only time you go through the legal incidents analysis is if there is no dispositive language placing the legal incidents.
You're getting short on time, but a lot of the brief that you've submitted deals with the use for highway funds. So am I correct that, you know, the highways, as I understand it, that go through the reservation, they're maintained by the state, built, a lot of them?
A lot of them are built and maintained by the state with a combination of state funds and federal funds. However,
the state funds would, part of those funds would be from what, a gas tax?
Lord, that's
because that's dedicated for that purpose.
Yes.
And is that the reason why the argument was made that is
it? No, it was not. The reason the argument was made was to establish the legislative history, particularly with reference to Congressman Hayden and ultimately Senator Hayden, about the expansion, the historical expansion of the gas tax to national parks and military reservations and ultimately Indian reservations, because the Congress wanted no escape from payment of the state gas taxes, and it was in conjunction with the Depression at that time which motivated that, and that's the reason for the history.
Your time has expired, Mr. Long.
Thank you.
Ms. Hogan, you have 10 minutes.
Your Honor, I'd like to start by following up on a question that the Chief Justice asked about, well, what has happened between 1936 when the statute was passed and now? What's really been going on with these motor fuel taxes? Well, one answer in South Dakota is absolutely nothing. I mean, at the administrative hearing, when the supervisor from the Department of Revenue, who was in charge of collecting these motor fuel taxes, was asked about the Hayden-Cartwright Act, she had no idea what she was even being asked about. In fact, she said, well, this doesn't have anything to do with what we're doing. This is a legal argument. This is an act that they dug up to try to fit in and say that the tax is authorized. But in fact, it's not used. Nobody files these reports that are required to be filed. And in fact, the Hayden-Cartwright Act doesn't really have anything to do with South Dakota's motor fuel tax being imposed.
So what you're saying, from 1936 till 1995, and your client runs afoul of the department, no taxes collected?
I think the taxes were collected. For one thing, South Dakota's motor fuel tax scheme changed in 1995. Prior to that time, and my understanding is that it was much clearer that the retailer had to pass the tax along at the pump. That has since changed in 1995, so that you do not have to, there's no requirement anymore that a retailer or a marketer, as the terminology is now, has to add that tax in and charge it at the pump. So,
has the commanding officer at Ellsworth Air Force Base filed a report, which he clearly would be mandated under the statute?
No, he does not, and that there was an affidavit to that effect in the record. No reports have been filed.
Is it the state's fault that these federal people aren't doing what they're ordered to do by federal law?
Well, it probably isn't the state's fault, although the state, I mean, the woman at the state who was in charge of this simply had never even seen it, didn't know what it was about, and I don't think that they were really relying on the Hayden-Cartwright Act as a basis for being allowed to tax.
So in answer to the Chief Justice's question, are you saying that the state of South Dakota imposed a motor vehicle fuel tax from 1936 to 1995, but it was a tax that was imposed upon the consumer, and so it was paid and never challenged?
As far as I know, it was never challenged. I can't say that I've gone back to look at South Dakota's motor fuel tax all the way from 1936 to the present. Just the testimony in the record was that nobody has ever complied with the Hayden-Cartwright Act, and the state has not relied on the Hayden-Cartwright Act as a basis for taxing in Indian country. It could well be that there were lots of consumers prior to 1995, Indian consumers, who could have filed for refunds and never did.
Well, why wouldn't have that been a reliance on the Hayden-Cartwright Act? The factual history of paying of taxes being imposed from 1936, if they were imposed on Indians, Native Americans, who are tribal members within the reservation?
Well, the state never claimed that they were relying on it until this litigation. Frankly, I think what happened, and clearly this is what happened.
There's nothing else in the world that they could rely on, is there?
That's the only read
they've got, though. How slim it is, we don't know, but that's the only read that they've got their lean on, isn't it?
Right.
So why can't we just as clearly say they were relying on that from 1936 to 1995?
Well, for one thing, because, I mean, they simply weren't doing it. That they weren't collecting these reports.
They still aren't, according to no reports are being filed now, right?
That's correct.
So what's different between that period of time and the later period of time, then?
Well, I guess perhaps it simply is that the state never asserted this as a basis for jurisdiction until now, and neither did any other states. That's why there just wasn't a lot of litigation on this.
So until your client came along, there was no gas tax collected on the reservation?
No, I think that there was. There have been gas taxes collected on the reservation. Part of what
it's
happened...
It's never been challenged.
It's never been challenged. Because prior to 1995, the legal incidence of the tax, it was required to be passed on to the consumers. The consumers were paying it. The consumers, particularly at Pine Ridge, as the record shows, buy very small amounts of gas. It's very unlikely that you're going to have a consumer. I think the average gas sale there is 4 gallons. That means at today's tax rate, you'd be talking about a consumer asking for an 88-cent refund. And you also have to file for a license as a consumer to be able to get a refund. So it's very difficult for a consumer to get a refund.
So what you're saying is the tax might have been collected, but the reports were never filed.
That's correct.
Okay.
But aren't 90% of the purchases, roughly 90%, done by consumers?
I think all of the purchases are by consumers, but 90% of them are Indians, and I think that the survey showed that 80% of them were enrolled members of the Oglala Tribe.
So it would be an awful lot of claimants asserting it for a small amount of tax.
Right, but each individual claimant would presumably have to file for a license.
After a while, if it gets close to a million like it has now, it adds up.
Right, but under the state's tax scheme right now, for any of those consumers to apply for a refund, they have to apply individually for a license before they have to have a license to get a refund, which is another disincentive, so that it's not so simple for all of them to just band together and apply for a refund. In addition to the fact that the state's own expert on motor fuel taxes had no idea what the Hayden-Cartwright Act even was at the administrative hearing, I want to talk a little bit about the Buck Act, because the department relies on this as something that 4 years later shows what Congress intended 4 years earlier in 1936.
Before you do that, Ray, you use the terms, Leon Poirier, doing business as Muddy Creek Inc. throughout this, and I guess that's unique in my experience. I've seen doing business as a private or as a sole proprietorship, doing business as a partnership, but I've never seen a reference to doing business as a corporation. I'm wondering what the basis is for that reference.
I think the basis is simply that Bat Poirier really is Muddy Creek Oil and Gas. He runs the whole thing. He is the sole owner, and it is his business. He's the one who has
a corporation. Is the corporation is a separate legal entity? It's not just an alter ego of the shareholders.
Well, for some purposes, it is deemed to be an alter ego. But as the cases we cited in our brief, I think, reflect, there are some times when you do look behind the corporate shell to the actual who is the owner of the corporation. And one of the times you do that, at least one of the times that other courts have done that, is to look to see should the corporation be treated the same as an individual Indian. In fact, we found a case from the Court of Appeals in New Mexico where there was a corporation 51% owned by individual tribal members of the Navajo tribe. The other 49% ownership was clearly non-Indian, admittedly non-Indian, and the court still found that that corporation retained the Indianness of that 51% ownership.
Well, I assume it's a practical matter with $1 million on the line if it's the difference between your client being a corporation and not being, he won't be one much longer.
I don't know if that's true or not. I think it's, I mean, for one thing, the department was supposed to issue these licenses in his name and they never did it. But also in the hearing process, on both the hearing process regarding those license appeals and the hearing process, in this case, the department basically said, well, Bat Poirier and Muddy Creek are one and the same to us. And so that's really why we left both parties in there, is that throughout, Muddy Creek and Bat Poirier have been considered one and the same. To finally touch on the Buck Act, when the Congress was considering the Buck Act 4 years after the Hayden-Cartwright Act, they were talking about sales taxes, and income taxes. They weren't refocused on the motor fuel question. And just the fact that the Department of Interior came along during those hearings and said, wait a second, we want to make sure that for property taxes and income taxes, we take Indian reservations and Indians out of that taxing authority, does not mean that in 1936, Congress intended, by using this phrase, United States military or other reservations, to include Indians. It simply cannot be unmistakably clear congressional intent in 1936 to have to look to what Congress did in 1940. Finally, with respect to the Goodman Oil case, I would point out to the court that, first of all, that case is not based solely on the Falls City Brewing case. So even if the court there made an error by relying on Falls City Brewing, there is other analysis to support the same position that we're advancing here, that there's no unmistakably clear intent. In the Coeur d'Alene versus Hammond case, what the court there said is, a state can't just slap a label in a statute saying the consumer bears the legal incidence and make it so. The U.S. Supreme Court has said the same thing in other cases, that for states to change the legal incidence of a tax from an Indian to a non-Indian, they can't just put a label on it. They have to actually change the structure of the statute, and South Dakota never did that.
Thank you, counsel. Your time has expired. The court will be in recess until 9 o'clock tomorrow morning.